So next week is what? Aluttavurudu. Meaning? New Year. So what is this week then? Week before New Year. Is this week also not New Year? Or today? How about yesterday? Was yesterday also not a New Year? So what is New Year's then? It's our convention, isn't it? Yes. But that does not stop us from coming up with an excuse to celebrate, come together as a community, as a people, one people. And these are things that are important parts of our culture. And they must be with us for now and forever, because it is what unites us. People who live together, they have to come together, they have to do things together for the betterment of humanity, to share with each other love, compassion, affection, all these things. These are all essential parts of society. Without this, we wouldn't survive as a human race. Humans need this sort of thing. People coming together, seeing people, seeing others, visiting your friends, being with relatives. So this is why we don't have a sermon next week. See, it's one thing to understand the absolute truths, but it's another to live a conventional life. That is an important part of our practice, ladies and gentlemen. Just because we talk about the absolute truths of the world and how ultimately there is nothing more than just matter and energy. Because if you think about the world in those terms, then there's no point in celebrating a New Year, is there? Because all there is just matter and energy. So what's New Year's then? Who are we going to meet? Who are we going to see? What's the point of having Kokis and Kaung and Kiribat and so on? Or if all there is just matter and energy? No, that's an absolute reality which is for us to comprehend. Through wisdom we understand that. This is why I always say our practice of Nibbana is a very private affair. It is not that this is not one that everyone needs to be part of. Each and every one of us, we work towards our salvation, and that is a very private affair. But when we are together, we conform to convention. We act accordingly. So next week, I want to give you time out so you can be with your friends, you can be with your family. Invite your relatives over, visit them, go and see them. And when you go, take with you some sweets. Take with you some food, some delicacies that you might prepare for New Year's. It's important. That's an important part of our culture. Because without a culture, there wouldn't be the fabric that weaves us all together. Otherwise, we would be merely strings that doesn't mean anything. But it's our culture that combines these strings together and weaves us together as one fabric, and therefore we can stand together, strong and united. If you were all arahatun vahanses, then fair enough. But on our journey there, we have to do this step by step. So I don't need, and I don't wish, and I don't want any of you to be a social oddity. That should not be part of what we do here. So once again, I want to share this with you right at the start. This is why we take time out next week. And even when the 31st comes around, right? If today were the first of the new year, first of the year, then again we wouldn't have a sermon today. Because these are important parts of our society, parts of our culture, and you should be with your friends, with your family. Otherwise, what would people say? They'd think that you have become a social piranha. They'd think that you have become very odd and very queer. And then they would not help you on your path to Nibbana. With the same vigor and energy and compassion and love that they encourage you and they support you, your visits on Sunday mornings to visit Rajagiriya, if you don't become part of them, or at least if you don't be with them when they need you, they will stop you. And it's not merely for that purpose. You must be part of society for as long as we are a social citizen. So, right at the start, I just want to share with you that we don't have a sermon next week. And we don't have sermons at the monastery either. So on the 14th, that is on the New Year's Day, even at the monastery, we all get together, we exchange betel leaves and we apologize for any mistakes that we've done to each other. Even on our quest to become a Rahatan Mahanse, we still do those things. Then we have the Kiribat Mese. So as a family, we get together. And then a few days later, after when we have the oil anointing ceremony, all our devotees, they visit us after they have done their own cultural practices at home and their rites and rituals and so on. We invite all of them to come to the monastery. And normally, you offer us meals, you offer us dhani, but on that day, we offer you. So you can form an orderly queue and come with plates in hand. And Guru Swami Nuhanse and the rest of our monks will be there to serve you. It is our way of showing you that we are all equals in this. We may be monks and you may be parts of the lay community, but for the purpose of Nibbana, we are all one family. It's not that we are better than you or you are less than us. It is not so, ladies and gentlemen. That is why I always say when you make a worship, that worship is not directed towards me. I don't take it personally. It's a worship to the Buddha, to the Dhamma, to the Sangha. The Buddha, Dhamma and the Sangha are the noble triple gems. I am not the fourth. So therefore your veneration, your obeisance, your mark of respect, your reverence, all of that is directed to that which is noble. And that which is noble are only threefold. The Buddha, Dhamma and the Sangha. We are all aspiring to that. Nibbana is the same for you and I. There's no difference there. Whatever values and virtues I must cultivate, so must you. Whatever values and virtues you must cultivate, so must I. There's no difference there. It's the Noble Eightfold Path for me. What is it for you? It's the five precepts for you. What is it for me? You know, I could condense the 227 precepts that I adhere to into the five that you adhere to. I can condense it all into five precepts. So what the Buddha has done with us is he has expanded it. So there are more minute detail. But ultimately, the five precepts is sufficient for one to get to Nibbana. If you adhere to the five precepts, ladies and gentlemen, you abstain from all sins, all evils. But of course, in a lay life, there are certain ways in which you interpret them so that it makes life livable. Otherwise, it becomes challenging to live a family life, to live a life with friends and to enjoy yourselves and entertain yourselves. But if you go and if you understand the profound meanings of these precepts that we adhere to, those precepts are sufficient for one to get to Nibbana. So that's the thing. You and I, we are all together, we are all in the same boat. It's not that I am the captain and you are the sailors. It's not so. We are all together in this. The only difference is, I learn the Dhamma, I practice the Dhamma every day of the week. Every waking moment, I'm with the Dhamma. That is why, on your request and on your invitation, I have come here to share with you what I have learned and what I have practiced from my teachers over the course of the past week. If you did that, then I'd come and listen to your sermon. It makes no difference. Are you any less human than I am? No. Are you any less wise than I am? Who can say that? Are you any less virtuous than I am? Who can say that? Who can claim to be so? It is not so. We are all equals in this game. And I'm not just saying this to please you. I actually mean it. We are all equals in this. Do you believe me when I say this? We are all equals in this. I need you to understand this. And that's when you will realize that you have an equal opportunity to get to Nibbana just as I do. That is why I always continue to make invitations to you to come and further your practice. Take it a little bit more forward. One notch, just one more rung on the ladder whenever you are ready. So in the new year, we'll be creating a few programs so that you can come and spend a little bit more time at the monastery. We'll be doing some meditation programs. I'll be particularly interested in those who might wish to become anagarikas and anagarikas over the course of the next year. So we'll be doing special programs for them. Because after all, you know, I want to help you achieve the same bliss, joy and ultimate freedom that I do. Because this is for all of us. So I have a few thoughts. We have a few ideas that we would want to do with you and give you more opportunities really. Because I know how difficult it can be and how challenging it can be to do what you have to do, which is the same that I have to do, but to get to Nibbana, all because the environment is different, that's all. You live in a different environment. Your seed and my seed, they are equally potent, they have equal potential. Does that make sense? Your seed and my seed, they have equal potential to grow on, to become great trees and bear good fruit. But the difference is the environment. For any seed to grow, become a big tree and bear good fruit, you need the right environment. You need good fertile soil. You need good sunlight. You need water. You need fertilizer. So any good farmer that's worth his salt, if he knows the potential that a seed has, he will make sure that it is planted in the right place, that it gets the fertilizer, it gets the water, it gets the sunlight, it gets love and affection and care, and they ward off the creatures that come to destroy it, put a fence around it, protect it. They would do all that would be necessary. That's exactly what I'm trying to do with as many people as I possibly can. That is the protection of the Mahasangha. It is what my teachers have done with me. It is what the Sangha community at the monastery do with me. I thrive in that community because of the environment, that's all. Otherwise we are equals. The only difference between you and I is the environment that we are in. You must understand this. That is the only difference. You are as capable as I am to get to Nibbana, no difference. Meaning your seed is as potent as mine, no difference. You have every merit that you need, ladies and gentlemen, to get to Nibbana, just as I do. We are no different in that way. But the difference is the environment. That is why the Sangha community was established by the Buddha. That is what we do at the monastery. You live at home and I live in that home. Two different environments. That is what will make a difference at the end of the day. So if you believe, as much as I do, that you have every potential to attain Nibbana, then try and keep yourself in the right environment as much as you possibly can. Bringing yourselves here on a Sunday morning is also bringing it into the right environment. It's like, you know, some of you might have pot plants at home. Right, from time to time you put it out in the sun, don't you? Yeah, to get a bit of sun, a bit of sunlight. That's what you do on Sunday mornings. You're like a pot plant. For the rest of the time, you keep it indoors. But when there's, you know, just the right amount of sunlight, you bring it here, you keep it here for a couple of hours. Right? And after the sermon, you water it a little bit. And the Swami Nuhansai walks up to you. And then you take it back and keep it indoors. But for the rest of the week, there's no sunlight. So the plant has to survive on whatever it got from Sunday morning. That's the difference between you and I. I am not a pot plant. I used to be one. And then what did I do? I rooted myself in fertile ground where the sun always shines bright. Always. There's plenty of water. There's plenty of fertilizer. There are plenty of noble associates who make sure that that which is unwholesome for me does not come anywhere near me. I always have someone to check whether what I'm thinking, what I'm doing, what I'm speaking is the right thing. And I always get the right advice. No, it's like having a doctor live at home when you are, a diabetic patient. If you are a heart patient, just imagine having your cardiologist live at home with you. Wouldn't that be nice? That's the environment that I live in. I am a mind patient and I have mental doctors who live with me at home. I have psychologists who live with me. So they're always there. Just a kuti away, just the next bed. Just a stone's throw away. All I have to wait is perhaps, you know, the most I have to wait might be a few hours. If everyone's asleep, then I just have to wait, you know, 4 or 5 hours until someone wakes up, and then I can go and ask them what I must do. And never would I get the wrong advice. When you are stressed, you go and ask a friend, what should you do? What do they say? Let's go. Let's go watch a movie. Let's go to a party. If you're stressed, say you're grieving over the loss of someone in the family. If you ask a friend, what must you do? If you're stressed at work, if you're, you know, if you got anxiety, anxious, they'll say, let's go have fun. Let's go to the beach. Let's go walk the dog. Let's go watch a movie. Let's invite some friends over. Let's listen to some music. Let's read a good book. Let's watch some TV. Let's order in a pizza. That's what your friends would say. None of these are the right answers. If the fire is over here, there's no point trying to put water to put out a fire on the other side. Where the fire is, that is where you have to put it out. See, that is the difference between you and I. No other difference whatsoever. If you cut me, I bleed the same way. Exactly the same way. I'm just as human as you all are. I eat the same things, we breathe the same air, we live on the same land. The same rules that apply to you apply to me, no difference, ladies and gentlemen. In fact, I have more rules than you do. You only have to adhere to the constitution. For me, there's that, and then the Buddhist constitution as well, on top of that. I have no TV. I have no newspapers to read. I have no entertainment, no music to listen to, no gigs to go to. I can't order whatever I want. If, you know, the middle of the night, I feel like a spot of pizza. What do you think I can do? You go to Pizza Hut. What do? I go to the next hut. where there'll be one of our other monks, or maybe my teacher, and I have to tell him, sir, I feel like a spot of pizza. What do you think he's going to do? Give me the phone, let me order it? No. He'll have me sat down and give me a lecture. He'll help me understand that the vexation is only internal, and that a pizza cannot satisfy me, really. This is why I progress day in, day out. Every day, every passing day, I'm a better man to the one I was the previous day. Every morning I wake up brighter. Every evening I go to bed smarter. So my life progresses one day at a time. This is what I want for as many of you as possible, ladies and gentlemen. We are all one. There's no difference. Whether you're man or woman, adult or child, whether you're a Buddhist or a Muslim or a Christian or a Hindu, ultimately, you know, we all suffer the same way, we all bleed the same blood, that's all. We're all the same. I'm not holier than you. I'm not more virtuous than you. I don't want you to think in that way. Because then it seems like, you know, a monk is unreachable. It's not. I'm a standard human being. Very standard. Very normal, very average human being. I don't have any superpowers, no supernatural powers. You know, sometimes you walk up to me and say, Swami Nasa, that sermon you gave, that was just for me. Did you read my mind? I promise you, I can't read minds. Never have been able to, and I don't think I ever will. I can't read minds, but here's what I can do. I understand minds. That much I can. I understand that minds vex because of ignorance and attachment. And I know that minds can be healed through the Dhamma. That much I can understand. Here's what I don't know. How the TV can heal the mind. I don't know that. I don't understand that. That concept fails me. How listening to a bit of music can heal you? Don't get that. I used to, but now I don't get that. Now it's a different philosophy. It doesn't make sense to me now anymore. (Laughs) That is how we are different, no other way. It's just the philosophy. This is why every week I encourage you to do the most you can, the best you can, ladies and gentlemen. Right? So with the turn of the new year, some of you will have started thinking about setting yourself some goals, maybe some ambitions for the new year, right? What you want to do. I say, get yourself into the environment as much as you possibly can. And we at the monastery, all of us, will do whatever we can. We will go as far as we can. Our Swaminuhanses, our Anagarika Mahatmas, our Anagarika Mahatmyas, right? We will do as much as we possibly can. Why don't some of you consider becoming a Sila Sravakas or a Sila Sravika? If you have the week vacant, right? Maybe you're retired now. Right? You have a few duties to attend to, a few chores to get done, but besides that, you can come and spend the week at the monastery. How much does that cost you? No, we don't charge you a penny. Well, you have to get yourself to the monastery, but besides that, you get your meals at the monastery, you get a teacher at the monastery. Every 2 weeks, you get a teacher's meeting. And I sometimes wonder, what if I could give you that exposure, you know, whereby you can come and sit down with a teacher, someone who takes responsibility, to some extent, at least half of the responsibility of your getting to Nibbana, half of it, the other half is always with you. But what if you can sit down with someone once a fortnight, right? Discuss with them the Dhamma points that you don't understand fully, the problems that vex you, and how you can apply the Dhamma to those situations. You know, that would be a rocket for you to Nibbana. Right now, you're on a bicycle. You can travel at the speed of light if you wanted to. The choice is yours. Then we have the Sila Vesi program, which is for those who are still at work. They have duties, they have children to look after and so on. But the weekends, they are available. So weekends, they come and spend at the monastery. On a Saturday and Sunday, they're at the monastery. So they have programs. They come and sit down with our Swaminuhanses and our Anagarika Mahatmyas, and they get counseling, they get advice, they discuss their problems and understand how to apply the Dhamma. That's all we do. Nothing magical, nothing miracles. We give them exposure to the Dhamma. And then if you feel you're ready for it, you can come and try out the Anagarika program. You can try it out. You can try it out for a whole 2 years. I mean, there's a mandatory 1 year training period, but if you feel like you're not ready for it yet, you can try another year. But because we don't have a permanent Anagarika program, at the end of 2 years, if you feel you're not ready, then you can go back home, you know, go back to what you've always been doing, and then once you feel you're ready again, you can come and try it again. So that's how far we are prepared to go to help as many people as we can. Because I understand, you know, we're all mothers, you're all fathers, you know, you're all people who have done something for this country, for this nation. Each and every one of you, you've contributed in some way. Among you are teachers. It is because of you our children have a good education. Maybe there's someone who's taught me when I was younger. Maybe there's some among you who taught my teachers. We're all one people. None of us can stand alone. It's all of us who look after all of us, isn't it? Some of you will be bankers, others will be lawyers, others will be engineers, some of you will be doctors and nurses, you know, people who make life livable. So if you have given something to our country, to our nation, to our community, to society, then you deserve something back. Something that you can take with you when you leave. Because the money in your bank account is not something you can take with you. You see, when you expended your life treating me when I was ill, you were the doctor, I was the patient, you gave me something you could never take back. No? You gave me something you could never take back, and that was time. Just think about it for a second. Every doctor who I've had the honor and privilege of having had treatment from gave me something that they could never take back. Even if I was ungrateful, they could never take it back. All of my teachers, They all gave me something they could never take back. Something that they brought with them through hard work, by doing merits. Human life I'm talking about. Don't you agree that you were all born human because of your own merits? It's not my merit, it's your merit. So you've been born human, and then you decided to be my teacher, you decided to be my doctor, you decided to be my nurse, you decided to be the postman who brought me my post every day, you decided to be the milkman, you decided to be the shopkeeper, the grocer. See? And it wasn't just the produce that you also gave up your time. That time was time that you earned. Human time. That was human time. You earned that time. Not the money I'm talking about. I'm talking about human time. You earned that time, and then you've spent it. You spent it on my behalf. By me, I mean every one of us. Just think about how much sweat, blood, sweat and tears you have shed developing our country, our nation. Don't you all feel that you deserve something? I wouldn't settle for rupees and cents. Because rupees and cents, once you spend it, you can earn it back. But what about the time that you spent? How do you earn that back? So I want for there to be a way in which you can be given back what you have spent. At least that. So that's something you can take with you when you leave. So these are some of the things that, you know, we discuss at the monastery with my teacher, with the other Swaminarayanas. We have a council that we call the Sangha Sabha. Our senior monks, we get together and we discuss that, what is the future of our monastery? What more can we do to help the people who are on their quest to attaining Nibbana? What more can we do for young children? What more can we do for people who are addicted to drugs? What more can we do for people who are addicted to sex? What more can we do to people who are addicted to the television? What more can we do to the elderly people? What more can we do for the younger people? We talk about all these things. How better can we serve the communities in which we live? How can we give ourselves up more? Because, you know, once we've given ourselves up 100%, that's when our job is done. That is what we're here for. We were born on this earth to give ourselves up in service to others. You have already started doing that. As a teacher, you've done. For the last 20 years, if you're a teacher, ladies and gentlemen, you gave yourself up. I don't think the rupees and cents could count for that. I don't think so. Because you were given something that can be taken back. But you gave something that can never be earned back. So how can they be the same? On the scales, your time versus money. One can be earned back. One, the other, can't. So when they say time is money, I disagree. If time is money, you should be able to exchange the two. Don't you think so? If you give time and you earn money, then you should be able to give money and earn time. You can't do that. Let's just say for the last 30 years, you've been doing your profession, and by this point, you've earned 100,000. Can you give the 100,000 back and earn your last 30 years again? Can you get it back? In case you decide, oops, I should have done something else with my life. Can you do that? No. So time is not money. It's not a one-to-one. It doesn't work like that. But if you have spent the last 30 years of your life serving our country, serving our people, out of your kindness, out of, you know, your sense of duty, then let us help you earn those 30 years back again. How do you do that? What did you spend? 30 years of human life, right? So how do you earn 30 years of human life? By serving. By serving yourself. By doing merits. By doing ping and by doing kusal. This is how you earn the 30 years back. This is how you earn. That's the environment that we have created at the monastery, and I want all of you to make as much use of it as you possibly can. It's great to see that some of you, you know, we see you at the monastery every other week, at least once a month. Many faces have become familiar faces at the monastery. That's great. I always say, you know, come empty-handed, leave with a full stomach. But also take something that is spiritually uplifting. You know, honestly, and I say this from the bottom of my heart, when you come into the monastery, you needn't bring anything with you. You know why? Because as a mother to me, over the last so many births in samsara, you have fed me enough. As a father to me, ladies and gentlemen, you've looked after me enough. You don't owe me anything. It is I who owe you. Because it is time for us to leave samsara. We are there because we want to get out of samsara, and it is our turn to repay those debts. Why don't you come and collect your dues? We are prepared to pay. Come on. I'm paying my debts so that I can clear my debts before I leave. I can't leave with my debts. I have to clear my debts. So therefore, I'm prepared to pay my debts. Why don't you come and collect your dues? The Swami Nuances are prepared to pay their debts off. Come and collect your dues. Anagarika Mahatmyas, they all consider you to be mothers and fathers. You know, you will already have, some of you have already given your children to the monastery. And they're already with us. But just because you don't have your biological child at the monastery today doesn't mean that you have not been a key part of who we have become today to practice as human beings. It is not my mother in this birth that made me human. It was my mother from my previous birth. My mother in this birth only gave me a womb to be born human. But I became human way before I came across and got to know my mother. It was my previous mother who kept me from doing evil things, unwholesome things, and encouraged me to earn merits and be a good person and go to the temple and, you know, do whatever. Help other people, be a kind person, be a generous person so that I could earn merits. That was my previous mother. Is it not possible that she's here somewhere in the audience? So you've already paid everything you have to pay. Now it's time to get your return. Your return on investment. You have made the investment already. Now come and get your returns. It's time to pay back. So come. Come swinging your arms. You don't need to bring any gifts. You don't need to bring anything. Just bring yourself. We are happy just serving you. After all, you know, you're a mind that has the potential to attain Nibbana. Nothing makes us happier. You know, it comes a point in our practice where we begin to realize my Nibbana and your Nibbana are not two different things. Some of you may understand exactly what I mean. Others will understand in a little while. There comes a point in our practice where we begin to realize that your Nibbana and my Nibbana are not two different things. There's Nibbana and Nibbana and Nibbana. That's it. The sense of self that you and I have, that is ignorance. So if one says, I have to attain Nibbana, I don't care about the rest of them, then that is ignorance speaking. So that can't be Nibbana. But once you start to dispel ignorance and you come into the light of wisdom, you begin to realize suffering is suffering is suffering for everyone. It makes no difference who suffers. There are not those who suffer, there is suffering. There aren't those who attain Nibbana, there is Nibbana, that's it. So therefore, you know, if I can help another person, another mind, to attain Nibbana, nothing makes us happier. That mind does not have to be this one, is what I'm saying. It doesn't have to be this one. Let's say I preach, I come here on a Sunday morning and I preach, okay? And if I can be guaranteed that week on week, two people in the audience attain Nibbana, but if I come and preach here, I don't get to attain Nibbana, I'm still prepared to do that because two people have attained Nibbana. If I didn't come here, one person attains Nibbana. If I come here, two people attain Nibbana. So, which is more advantageous? Coming here and doing the sermon. Because two people have attained Nibbana. It doesn't have to be me. Someone has to attain Nibbana. That's it. But that doesn't, you know, if I can have that kind of attitude, then the first person to attain Nibbana will be me. That's the thing. One who doesn't care about oneself and begins to think about the bigger picture, they are already on the path to Nibbana. Otherwise you could wonder, you know, Swaminasa, don't you care about your own practice? Isn't that what the Buddha said? Because last week that was the talk that you gave. Right? Don't just go around preaching the Dhamma, you got to concern yourself about yourself and getting yourself to Nibbana, otherwise you'll become a potila. That was the sermon I gave last week. But the point is, if you, with your understanding of the Dhamma, begin to focus less on oneself and begin to focus more on reality, on the truth, on the goodness for all, on what is good for all, one and for all, then they are well and truly on the path to Nibbana. So in the new year, I want you to start to think about what sort of goals you can have, particularly on this journey to your salvation, ladies and gentlemen. Because every other facet of life, there will be those around you to remind you. There will be those around you to remind you, when are we going to finish building the house? When are we going to finish putting the next story up? When are we going to buy the car? There's going to be someone with you to remind you that. When are we going to put the children to a better school? When are we going to go on that trip? When are we going to earn that? Whatever. People, they'll be there. There'll be people there around you to remind you that. When are we going to have that party? But no one's going to ask you, when are you going to work towards your salvation? So that is why I feel it is my duty to remind you of that. And it is your duty to start making some goals. Put some down, you know, in pen and paper. If you can, at least make a firm resolve, right? Maybe once a month, you make a resolve. I will come to the monastery. Because you can book your sessions with monks or with an Anagarika Mahatmya. If there are, you know, there may be ladies here who have issues to discuss, which you might struggle to discuss with the Swamin Mahanse because you feel it's not appropriate. Fair enough. That's why our Anagarika Mahatmyas are well and truly equipped to talk about these issues. They get to listen to the same Dhamma that we do. A Guru Swami Nuanse gives a sermon to all of us. There are no special sermons for monks and different sermons for Anagarikas. It's not so. We all get treated the same way. It's one home, one family. We are all children of the same father. So we all get treated the same way. No different there. Then there may be young men here who have problems that you want to discuss with the Swami Nuanse. Maybe there are secrets that you have kept harbored in your heart and in your mind and you just want to get it out because it's tormenting you. You can't share it with your wife, you can't share it with your brother, you can't share it with your father or your best friend. But you want to just get it out because it eats you from the inside. Well, you can come and confide in a Swami Nuanse. You can come and make a confession if you want. Knowing that all you will get back is an ear that will listen to what you have to say and then some advice, the right kind of advice to help you come out of that situation so that you don't fall victim again. Because we don't put it on the newspapers. We don't spread it around like, you know, wives' tales. We don't do that. So the Dhamma is there for everyone. The Buddha Sasana is there for everyone, ladies and gentlemen. You just have to come and take it. Once again I say, you know, come empty-handed. You have already paid in advance, all of you. There's nothing more you need to pay. Now come and reap the rewards of your hard work, your labor, your toil. You have served our country for so many years. You have served this nation for so many years. The reason today we still have independence may be partly because of what your sacrifices. Maybe you gave up your sons and daughters for our independence. There may be mothers and fathers here who sacrificed their children. Today we have independence because of that. We live in a free country. We are free to do as we choose to. You develop the schools, you build the schools. You taught our children, our siblings. It doesn't have to be my child that you taught. You taught a child. And that child will go on to do great things in this world. Make this world a better place for many people. So, you deserve something for having done so. So, let me do my part. Let us do our part. Let the Swami Nuhansas at the monastery do their part. Let them show their gratitude to you. All you have to do is go and put yourselves there so that we can serve you. Right, well, that's not what I came here to talk about. So let's observe the precepts. And I want to share with you some of the Dhamma points that we've been discussing lately. And actually I want to try and wrap it all together. So to connect the dots between some of the things that we've been learning and discussing over the last few weeks. So you have an end-to-end structure that you can sort of have in your mind that you can reflect on. So last week, the following next week, we are not going to have a sermon. So even if you fail to come to the monastery or whatever reason you are not able to listen to the sermons, over the next week you'll have something to do. I just want to help to piece all the Dhamma that we have learnt over the past few weeks, months together, so you have something structured that you can reflect on. Right, let's observe the precepts and make progress. Okay. So before we begin, let us bring our palms together in veneration of the Lord Buddha, our teacher, our master, and our guide. And as we do so, let us also remind ourselves that this is us renewing our pledge, our oath, to keep ourselves steady on the path to Nibbana and to ultimate bliss.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa.
What we're going to try and do today is to try and summarize what we have learned over the past few weeks and months, as well as try and connect some dots, because I appreciate that I get carried away sometimes. And then we discuss various bits of the Dhamma. So I want to try and help you piece the picture, connect those dots, so you have a streamlined principle that you can reflect on to apply your learnings, what you have understood in the Dhamma, to help you to relieve yourself, or rather free yourself from suffering. Not relieve from suffering, but free from suffering. Now last week, if you recall, we talked about the fact that beauty is not in an object. That is why we refer to it as the sacrifice of beauty, if you remember. So I asked you, well, we discussed the homework that I'd given you the previous day, previous week, and then for those who had forgotten to do their homework, I asked you to give it another go this week or last week. Right? Just get back home and look at the things you have around you in your living room and at home and ask yourself the question, how many of those things can actually give you pleasure versus the number of times where you live with fear and worry that something might happen to it or someone might take it from you, and ultimately it's just a constant source of stress and anxiety and worry rather than a source of pleasure. We as human beings, if we go back right to the basics, ladies and gentlemen, we've grown up thinking, we tend to think that our happiness comes from the outside world. Right? We are all guilty of that. It started right from when we were in the cot. As our parents would walk up to us, our elders would walk up to us, your grandmother would walk up to you, she would hold something in your face, maybe a teddy, right? Maybe something glittery, maybe something that makes some nice sound, some music or whatever, and they would hold it in front of you and expect you to smile, to laugh, to be cheerful. So constantly this was teaching you, without using words, because you couldn't understand language, but you could understand their gestures, you could understand what they were trying to say, you tried to make sense of the world as young children, we all do, and you were beginning to gather from what they were trying to teach you rather, that happiness has to come to you from the outside world. In fact, even when your mother used to tell you, my little one, my darling, how happy I am to have you with me, to hold you in my arms, to cuddle you, to kiss you, to caress you. You see, your mother is indoctrinating you that her happiness comes from whom? Comes from you. Now you've got to forgive her because she had no teacher, she had no teaching. She didn't know any different. So as the mother tells you this, as your father tells you this, as your parents tell you this, right, you think, well, it must be true then that happiness has to come to us from the outside world. So what is there in the outside world? You began to learn as young people and as people, you know, as we grew up, we began to learn that there are objects in the outside world, didn't we? There are objects of various sizes, various shapes, various colors. There are physical objects. Then there are occurrences in nature, like a sunset or a sunrise. You know, you looked up to the sky and you went stargazing. Then, remember when you were younger, you were taken to your garden. And then your mother, your father would point to you, you know, to the rabbit. Say, look at that little bunny, Pata. Isn't it so cute, so pretty? Aren't you happy to see one? They'd say things like that. So again, you know, you're being indoctrinated. Then they would bring you a pet squirrel, maybe a pet cat, a pet dog, a pet whatevers, right? Pet birds, pet fish, whatever. And then they would teach you to experience them and enjoy their association. Constantly, constantly, relentlessly teaching you and indoctrinating you that your happiness has to come from the outside world. So no wonder then that you had to learn a way in which to acquire the things that was going to make you happy. No wonder. So now you see why the education system is so that you learn how to acquire the things that you need in your life. I mean, besides the basic requisites, we all need the air to breathe, we need food to eat and so on, but you know, our education system is so sophisticated now that we learn how to acquire even virtual things. Isn't technology mostly an entity that gives rise to a virtual world? You know, today you have VR headsets and so on, you know, virtual reality. Look at what education has given us. Physics, science, you know, it has given us, technology has given us a way in which we can live a world that does not really exist. All because we think our happiness has to come to us from the outside world. So if you're feeling stressed, if you're feeling down, if you're feeling depressed, all you've got to do is put on that VR headset, open your eyes and you're in a different world. Then from that point until you take it off, you are shut off from the real world. You can just forget about what's going on in the real world and then live a virtual life. Computer games help us do this. Films and songs and music and all of these things, it help us do it. So you see how this human condition that we are all in, you know, we got ourselves into it. We have all gotten ourselves into a situation where we believe our happiness has to come from the outside world. So if our happiness has to come from the outside world, there has to be a way to acquire these things, and that's where money comes in. And this is why in today's day and age, to be someone, you have to be someone who has money. That's why wealth is so highly regarded in today's day and age. Don't you get the logic there? If happiness comes from the outside world, and to acquire these things you have to give something in exchange, right? Nobody wants your pet dog in exchange for a loaf of bread. What they want is money so that they can buy whatever they want, right? So we have a common medium that everyone can buy anything for. It's liquid. You can exchange money for anything you want, right? Almost anything. So, if this is the case, then of course those who have money are hard to be treated as people who have attained success in life. But then, when you look at reality, just because someone has money, just because someone is wealthy, they're not really happy. So this is where our quest begins. Growing up in a world where we believe to have is to be happy, you then go back around and ask people, those who have, the question, are you really happy? A man who has a mansion, a man who has a swimming pool in his house, a man who has a tennis court in his house, a man who has a big car, a man who has a big ship, a man who has a big plane, a man who has a big wife, not big wife, slim wife, small wife, a man who has a lot of things, right? You go and ask them, are you really happy? A man who has a big bank account, are you happy? Ultimately they say, no, I thought it was going to make me happy, but alas, I'm not really. So you see, what we were promised at the beginning does not tally with the end, the answer at the end. You know, this is bad business. Don't you think so? You've given a forecast at the beginning of the year, but at the end of the year, you can't meet your targets. You're completely off. This is bad business. So if this is bad business, then we need to figure out where we went wrong. That's where the Buddha Dhamma comes in. It gives you a different paradigm, a new way of thinking. It's a paradigm shift. Where we've all grown up thinking that happiness has to come to us from the outside world, and therefore also suffering. Don't you see the connection? If happiness comes to us from the outside world, then so does suffering. You see, if you believe that this makes you happy, then who decides when you are happy or not? I do. Now, where does suffering come from? Also the outside. Because if I can give this to you, I mean, let's say I can only give one of you. No, I can only give this to one of you. So there's only one of you who's going to go home happy today. The rest of you are going to go home unhappy. And who decides that? I decide that. So again, your source of happiness and your source of suffering are both external to you. You see? It's bad business. You can never profit from this. So therefore, we now have a dilemma. We are in a problem, we are in a conundrum, and we need to find a solution to this. Thankfully, the Buddha comes along and he says, stop and listen. You got it wrong. You screwed up. The truth is, happiness is not in the outside world. Happiness is not in the objects out there. Happiness is not in the material possessions. Happiness cannot be acquired by wealth. Happiness cannot be acquired from the outside world. So therefore, having many possessions is not the way for someone to be happy. But just because he says so, it doesn't need to be so. It is down to each and every one of us to engage in a study of what he has said, to make sense of it each for ourselves. So let's do that then. We worked on some basic principles, on some basic truths, such as, if this is something that is a source of happiness, it must bring happiness to all of you, right? But it is not so. So we took an example of, you know, I asked you what is your favorite item of food? And everyone has a different answer. So the one you have will not be the one the next person. The person next to you will have a different answer. But it is your favorite item of food because you believe that it brings you happiness. If it is, let's say cake for instance, a chocolate cake. Not everyone here will like chocolate cake. Some will like strawberry cake. Others will like vanilla cake. Others may not like cake at all. As I said, 10% of the population, they don't even like chocolate. But although people, you know, generally people think that chocolate makes us happy. Not necessarily. There are some who don't like it. Then there are some who like dark chocolate. There'll be, I'm sure, people in the room who hate it. They just won't like the taste of it at all. So therefore, that you cannot say that there are objects in this world that bring you happiness. It's wrong to say that objects in this world bring you happiness. Let's take a couple more examples. You'd say that your best friend brings you a lot of happiness. Why is your best friend not my best friend? Why do I have a different best friend to the one that you have? It's because you believe that your best friend brings you the most amount of delight and happiness, but my best friend brings me happiness. So therefore, again, happiness is not something that a person or an object can offer you on a plate. These are basic principles, basic logics, basic theorems that we can apply into our lives. So now that we are okay with that concept, that objects in themselves do not inherently have the characteristic of happiness to offer you. Yeah, objects have weight, they have dimensions. In a three-dimensional space, you can plot an object. You can say it has length, it has weight, it has breadth, and it has weight. Such cannot be said about happiness of an object. So happiness is a wholly subjective thing. It's not an objective thing. Are we all in agreement with that before we proceed to the next step? Is there anyone in this room who believes, no, Swami Nohansa, I still believe that there are objects out there that can give me happiness? Anyone? All you got to do is put your hand up and I'll go through it again. Anyone in the room who thinks that objects out there can bring you happiness? Excellent. So you all agree that it cannot be so. This is why today we live in a world where you have so many things in the marketplace, because not one thing makes everyone happy. If one thing makes everyone happy, you only need one kind of jam. Yeah? So one of you will be strawberry jam, the other will be mango jam, the other will be pineapple jam. If strawberry jam makes everyone happy, why do you need another flavor? So just walk down the aisles, have a look at all the different flavors that jam comes in, and that in itself should be evidence to you that objects do not bring you happiness. Well, there you go. Right, so the next question is then, what is it that objects bring you? If they don't bring you happiness, what do they bring you? To answer that, we can look back at ourselves. If you just walk in front of a mirror, you will have the answer to these questions. When you are stood in front of a mirror, you will see that you have a pair of eyes. You have a pair of ears. Stick your tongue out and you'll see your... No, not now. You'll see you have a tongue, a nose, and you have your skin, right? So your body, a sense of touch. So there are five things that your body is prepared to take in from the outside world. Yeah? These five things, once again, are sights, sounds, smells, taste, and touch. This again is wrong, but I'll come to that in a moment. So have we agreed initially that objects don't bring us happiness? We are all in agreement with that? Okay. But you still think that objects bring you sights, sounds, smells, taste, touch. Not so. Once again, we got it wrong. So let's try and work through that. If you can follow through with me on this part, the one that I'm trying to outline for you, at the end of this conversation, you will realize that objects bring you nothing at all. Once you realize that objects bring you nothing at all, you will no longer have an attachment to any object. You will have no value in them. They would not be worth anything to you. The only reason you let go of something is when you realize it has no value. When you throw this pen in the bin, would I throw it today? Why not? It writes. Therefore, it has value to me. Because when I want to write, I can use this. I mean, you know, honestly, I don't want the pen. I want to write. Yeah? I want to be able to write. This pen helps me do that. Therefore, I want this pen. You get that? So it's by proxy, I want this pen. I want to be able to write. The pen helps me do that. Therefore, I keep this in my possession. I look after it. I take care of it. I protect it. And I keep it secure. The day that comes where I can no longer use this to do what I want to do, which is to write, I will no longer care about this pen one bit. Not an iota. This will be in the bin before you even know it. Agreed? In the same way, once you understand that objects do not offer to you what you expect of them, they will be in the bin. You will not have an attachment to them. Today, you suffer because you are attached to the objects in your life. You are attached to your car, aren't you? You are not just attached to a mode of transport. No, no. You are attached to your car. If it's just a mode of transport, would you be happy to swap your car with another one? There will be some among you. You are very attached to your car. Your car, your car, your car, my car, not nobody else's car, my car. That's because you believe your car is a source of pleasure for you. The body needs a mode of transport. What does the mind need? Mind needs nothing. Mind doesn't need a mode of transport. It's the body that needs that. So if the body can be given a mode of transport, why does it have to be your car? Why does it have to be a car? There you go. Now think about the ornaments that you have at home, for instance. What do they offer you? Physically, what do they offer you? Nothing. The grandfather's clock that you keep at home, what does it offer you? You can't tell me that is what I used to look the time, Swami. Well, you don't need something so big to check the time. Just have a wristwatch or something. Have a little clock. You know, one of these things will do. But no, that grandfather's clock you are attached to. What about the armchair that you have at home? Yeah, that one I'm talking about. You know the one I'm talking about. The one that got passed down from your great-grandfather to your grandfather to your father, and now it's at home with you, that armchair. What does that offer you? You can't tell me it's a place to sit, because hardly anyone sits there. It's your family, it's your heirloom, but it's there. What does it offer you? Physically, it offers you nothing. But you are still attached to the object. At this point, I'm reminded of something quite nice, and I thought I should share it with you. Apparently, and I can't remember saying this, but apparently in some sermon some while ago, I'd asked people to share or to give away their most, whatever they're most attached to. Apparently I'd done that. I can't remember. Maybe you can. So one person in the audience had actually taken this quite seriously. You know, hats off, honestly. You know, to be able to do that is just marvelous. So there was a lady in the audience. I think she's a regular. See her quite often. So she went back home that day. She went, looked at home. She asked herself, which object am I most attached to? So she walked into the living room. Which object am I most attached to? Made a mental note. Walked into the kitchen. Which object am I most attached to? Walked into the bedroom. Which object am I most attached to? So she walked around the house. And then she came back to the living room. And she realized, yeah, that's the thing I'm most attached to. The sofa. You know what she did? She made a resolve. If this is the thing that I'm most attached to, I want to give this up. So now we have a sofa at the monastery. I didn't mean it literally. But nonetheless, it's great, don't you think so? The fact that someone can actually do that, you know, what I appreciate there is not them giving up a sofa. What I appreciate is them having done what I asked them to do. They actually, literally went back home, scanned the room, scanned their house, all their material possessions, and asked themselves the question, which object am I most attached to? Which one am I struggling to give up? Because you see, if you don't give it up now, you will never give up even when you're dead. You'll come back for it. You know this. That's why the dead don't stay dead. They come back for the things that they're attached to. If they're attached to their children, they'll come back for their children. If they're attached to the grandchildren, they'll come back to the grandchildren. If they come attached to the sofa, they'll come back for the sofa. Now, I don't expect it would have been easy. I don't expect it would have been easy. But here's what she would have done. She would have been to-ing and fro-ing with it. Do I give it? Do I not give it? Maybe I'll go for something else. I don't know. You know, is this too much? You know, can I actually live with myself after I've given this up? Because I think it's been passed down to her from her family. It's something that has been passed down from generations, I believe. But then at some point she would have thought, you know, I'm here born as a human being to work on my attachment. I need to rid myself of attachment. The sofa someday is going to be lost anyway. Either the sofa is going to break down or I'm going to break down. One of these two things is going to happen sooner or later. But if I have the Dhamma and I have my teachers and I can apply the Dhamma and free myself of the attachment I have towards this sofa, then I'm a free person. Then whatever happens to the sofa, I don't need to worry about. In fact, that's all I wanted them to do. You know, I'm never an advocate of you giving away everything you have at home. You know, you can keep them. Keep whatever you need at home. All my only concern is that you are mentally attached to them, not physically. Physically, be attached to as you know everything in the world if you want to. Physically, you can be attached to whatever you want. But mentally, you've got to be able to give up. It's the mental attachments that keep bringing you back, not the physical attachments. So if you have a wristwatch on you, if you have a necklace on your neck, right? If you have a crown on your head, it's fine, keep it. These are the physical attachments. But mentally, you've got to be able to give up. So anyhow, I just thought I'd share that with you so that you can rejoice in one person's victory. But now don't you all go back home, because we have limited space at the monastery. One sofa is enough. Right, so don't you all go back home, unless of course you're attached to your children, then it's fine. Right? If you're attached to your son or your daughter, and you go back home and you think that is the object that I'm most attached to, that's fine, we can have a conversation about that. But material objects, keep it at home. All I mean is let go of your mental attachment, not the physical attachment. Alright? Don't bring them to the monastery. So, we've come to the point where we have today understood that happiness is not in the object, but now we believe that sight, sound, smell, taste and touch, these things come from the object. I'll take one or two to work through so that we can further examine whether the premise in which that we work is actually founded in truth or whether it's a lie after all. Let's take sight because that's a good one. Once again, I resort to my favorite pen. Most of our sermons are about a pen, isn't it? Yes. Without pens, I don't know where it would be. So take this pen for instance. You see a pen that has a black cap and a white barrel. And when you see this object, when you see these colors, you know you're looking at an object. In fact, if you all went colorblind right now. So by colorblind, I don't mean black and white. I meant if you actually lose sight altogether, you wouldn't be able to see this at all. The reason that you see this object here is because you see a contrast. The background is a different color to the foreground. You see the black is a different color to the white. If the barrel was also black, would you be able to tell them apart? You wouldn't be able to distinguish them. If the background was also, if say the barrel and the cap were both black and the background was also black, would you see the pen? No. If I change the color of the background to white, you would now only see the cap, but you still wouldn't see the barrel. Because you need contrast. That is how you see. In other words, what you see is color. Does that make sense to everyone? What you see is color. You see, now this is a whiteboard. If I had something pure white, let's just take this. I know this is not pure white, but if I held it like this, because they're the same color, you would struggle to see this. If they were the same color, you'd struggle to see it. But if I change the color of the board, now you'd begin to see this. So the way we see things, ladies and gentlemen, is by seeing color. Does that make sense to everyone? Without color, we wouldn't be able to see anything at all. Then the question is color actually in the object? That's the next question. If it is color that we see, is color in the object? If color was in the object, then the light that falls on an object would not have any effect on the color that we see. So, right now, you see this color, this shade of black, because of the ambient light. Change the light that falls on this object and you change the color that you see. Now, maybe the next time, next sermon, I'll bring with me a few examples to convince you that color is not in the object. Like we did this yesterday's sermon, on Saturday. If you get some time, go back and watch it. If not, I'll bring some examples with me, not next week, of course, the week after, and I'll convince you that color is not in the object. But we can convince ourselves enough already. You see, these objects, they have pigments. That is what they have. Pigments are merely arrangements of matter, and what they do is, when energy falls on that object, it absorbs some of that energy and it emits the rest of it. That's why you see this color. In fact, what black does is it absorbs much of the energy. Because very little energy that actually falls on this object is reflected back to you. Very little of it is reflected back to you. That is why this appears to be dark. So why does this appear light? Because a lot of the energy that falls on this object is reflected back to you. Therefore, you see this to be light. So as you may have learned from school, from your school days, we have rods and cones in our eyes, yeah, in our retina. And these rods and cones, they respond to light waves. What are light waves after all? They are electromagnetic waves that carry energy. Okay? So these light waves, when they fall on your rods and cones, which are little receptors at the back of your eyes, now I'm simplifying this because I appreciate not everyone may remember the science that they've learned at school, others may not have learned science at school. There may be some in the audience who've never been to a school. Can they not attend Nibbana? Matters not. It doesn't matter. I have an aunt who's never been to school. And I still teach her the Dhamma whenever I get a chance. That's okay. Sunita and Sopaka, they'd never seen a school, let alone be to one. So you don't need to have had a school education to attain Nibbana. But it helps because when you take examples, it's easy to understand. So if you remember your science from school, you will recall that color is not in the object. These are just merely pigments. What do pigments do again? They reflect energy that falls on them. On a molecular level, there are molecules that make up this object and there are electrons that surround the object, and when energy falls on these electrons, they jump from one level to another, and as they do that jumping up and down, energy is emanated from the object, is emitted from the object, or rather reflected. So that is an in-depth explanation of it, but for the time being, let's just understand that there are only pigments here. Now, if there are only pigments here and there is no color in this object, how does this become colorful? For this, we have to just take another deep dive into understanding how the optical system works in our human bodies. This is all really simple stuff. None of this has to be complicated because it's not. And if this seems a little bit complicated, it's only because you may be hearing this for the first time, right? As I say, there may be some who may not recall what they've learned for science at school, and it's okay. Don't worry about it. Really simple stuff. So let me draw an eye for you. So here's the pen. This is the pen. There's a light source. Light falls. And light is reflected. And the same here. Light falls on the retina, which is at the back of the eye. There are two types of receptors that are called rods and cones because of the shape. They're characteristically of that shape. And what they do is, they convert electromagnetic waves into current waves. So there's an optic nerve that takes this message to your brain, which is to your optic center, which is at the back of your head. This is called the optic nerve. And as you know, so you have the left eye and the right eye, and they cross, right? This is just stuff you've learned at school anyway. Now, you see, to prove to you, here's another piece of evidence to prove to you that color is not in the object. If color were in the object, what's traveling in these nerves? They are neurons. They are myelinated neurons. Meaning, they work on an action potential. Meaning, it's a current. What things do current have? What does a current have? They have a weight, don't they? I'm just pulling your leg. Of course they don't have a weight. They don't have a weight. What do they have? They have a voltage. Yeah? So if it's a current, it has an amperage. If you want, you can measure this resistance. So these are some of the characteristics of current. What color is current? Does it have a color? It doesn't have a color. So if by the point it gets to your optic nerve, it has to be coded into an electrical current, then even if there was color in the object, by this point all that color detail would have been lost, wouldn't it? Because color cannot be conveyed on an electrical conductor. Once again, let me repeat that. Even if color was a characteristic of an object, in other words, even if color was there in the object, by the point it gets to the back of the eye and it's time to translate that electromagnetic wave into an electrical wave, at that point all color detail would have to be discarded. Do you all agree with me on that? Why is that? Because now it's going to be a current. If it's a current, it cannot carry a detail of color, because current doesn't have a color. Is this making sense to you?
So I want to say, is the sky and sunset
is a good example of the sunset and the sky? It has different colors at different times. Yes, it's a good example, but I'm just... Anything would be a good example. Because what I'm trying to help you understand at this point, just at this point, is that we cannot, even if there was color in the object, it would be useless for us, because at this gate, all color detail is lost. Let me try and give you an analogy to this. Okay. Imagine this, right? Now, you all walked into this room. Let's just say, by the gate, there's a gatekeeper. As you enter through the gates, you have to leave all your material belongings. They give you a locker, and you have to leave all your material belongings there. Let's just assume that that was the case. So you can't bring any money, your wallet, any prize possession, you have to leave there by the gate. So then when you walk in, you're only clad in whatever you've come dressed in. That's it. You can't bring any other material, valued possessions. But as you walk in, and you walk in through these doors, each of you is given some money. Okay? This is an assumption. Each of you is given some money. Don't come asking where it is, because this is just an assumption. So each of you is given some money, and then, as time passes, you can exchange money with each other. There are no rules against that. You can exchange money with each other. And after a while, when I ring the bell and we ask you, how much money do you have with you? Some will have more money than others. Yes, some will be richer, some will be poorer. But this cannot be the money that you brought with you. Why so? Because you had to leave everything by the gate. Because the gatekeepers were instructed to strip you of all your money. Your personal belongings cannot be brought with you beyond the gates of the school. But once you enter through these doors, you get given some money, and that is the money that you can share amongst each other and you can keep in your possession. Now, in a similar way, even if you brought money with you, which is like, even if the object had color, at this gate, you have to drop it all. Why is that? Because once you become a current, color cannot be a characteristic that can be conveyed from the eye to the brain. So if color cannot go any further than the retina, then even if this had color, it would all have to stop at the retina, wouldn't it? Because by the time it gets to the optic center of your brain, there would be no color detail. All there would be is a current with a voltage, an amperage, and maybe some resistance. Because it's just an energy. Does that make sense? If it doesn't, just put your hand up again. I'll go through a few more examples. Anyone? All good with that? Made sense? Okay. Right. So, the conclusion that we can come to then at this junction is color, my hypothesis is that color is not in the object. To evidence that, I'm presenting to you the fact that color cannot travel, even if color were in the object, it cannot travel any further than the retina, because at this point it has to become electrical current so that it can be conveyed or carried on a nerve, which is essentially a wire, to the brain. Right. So then, now that we know that this is an electrical current, and we know that there is no color, but yet we see color, then where has color got to be produced? It's got to be after this point, right? Somewhere after this point. It cannot be before this point. So it has to be somewhere after this point. So now it gets to the brain. At the brain, what we have just received is an electrical impulse. So it's like this is a wire that's carrying electrical current and you just touch the brain. And now the optic center of the brain is stimulated by an electrical current. Once the brain is stimulated, now remember we are conscious beings, so there is the energy of consciousness that works in each and every one of us, so therefore now consciousness has to kick in. I mean, this is why we see in the first place, because we want to be conscious about what we see. So consciousness, it's time for consciousness to take place. In other words, for the mind to do its part. So far, the mind hasn't been involved. How so? You have the object, you have the eye, you have the optic nerve, you have the brain. Nothing about the mind has gotten involved just yet. Now is the moment where the mind steps in. So these are all slaves for the mind, so that the mind can make use of these tools to be conscious about the world that it lives in. Do we have color at this point? No. Going back to the first point that I made at the start of this conversation, if there was no color, would you be able to see this object? No. So, right now, you can't actually see this object. At this point, you can't see this object, because you haven't seen color yet. And if there's no color, you can't see the object. But what you have are pigments. What are pigments again? Matter configured in such a way so that when energy falls on it, it absorbs some of it and it reflects some of it back. Okay? Right, now we are at the brain. It's time for the mind to kick in. Now you know how the mind works because we've talked about this before. There are the five aggregates. What are they again? Rupa, Vedana, Sanya, Sankara and Vijnana. These are the five aggregates. Rupa, Vedana, Sanya, Sankara and Vijnana are like the five steps of a process that result in a mind. In other words, you can't talk about a mind that is independent of Rupa, Vedana, Sanya, Sankara, Vijnana. The very occurrence of Rupa, Vedana, Sanya, Sankara and Vijnana is the mind. So you can't talk about the mind doing Rupa or the mind doing Vedana, the mind doing Sanya, the mind doing Sankara or the mind doing Vijnana, because there is no separate mind here that does all these things. This is the mind. It's called the mind because it minds. It's called the minding process. Please mind the gap. Yes, between the train and the platform. You have to mind. What do you mind? You mind an object. You child mind. Yeah, you mind the child. Mind the gap. Mind. Minding is a verb. It means to mind. This is what minding means. You know, if ever you wondered, when someone says, please mind, do you mind? Please mind the gap. Can you mind the child for me while I'm away? What minding actually means is this. If you were to elaborate what minding is, if you wanted to define what minding is, it is this. See how profound the Buddha's wisdom is. Have you ever thought that minding was all of these things? Five-step process to minding. So you can't have a mind that does not have the rupa function. These are functions. The Vedana function, the sanya function, the sankara function and the vijnana function, these are functions. These functions together is the mind. Once again, I want to emphasize this point. It is not that there's a separate mind somewhere that goes and do a bit of rupa, goes and does a bit of vedana, goes and does a bit of sanya, sankara and avijnana. That's not how it works. Rupa, vedana, sanya, sankara, vijnana are the five steps when together considered is the mind. In other words, these things, when they work in unison, together, that is when we say minding is happening. Make sense? Clear to everyone? Clear as mud? Yes, ma'am. Yes, ultimately, yes. So, perceiving is also part of the minding process. So, this is where we get to perception. Exactly. Yeah, well done. So this whole process is a chitta. So our consciousness or a chitta, you know, we use these words interchangeably. But it's when this has happened, it's when the whole thing has happened, can we say that I can now see the pen. You can't stop this process at anywhere before it has become a vijnana, because before it has come to the last step of the process, which is vijnana, to claim to have seen a pen, or color for that matter. Now I'm going to explain to you how that works. The ultimate objective of this explanation is not to make you become scholars or teachers or, you know, specialists in how any of this works. That is not my interest. My interest is merely this, to help you understand that it is not the object that has sight. Sight is a fabrication that happens within the mind itself. Then you should have a question at the end of that conversation, which is, why do we care? I'll come to that in a moment. But before we get there, let's just quickly understand how this process works. Now we've come so far as to the brain, where we have this is called a sight rupa, or in Sinhala we call it Rupa Rupa, or it is also in Pali you can call it a Rupa Rupa. So because we are speaking about this in English, let's call it a Sight Rupa. So what is a Sight Rupa? A Sight Rupa is merely an impression. It's an impression, it's a mental impression of the object that has been placed in front of the eye. Look at it this way for a second, ladies and gentlemen. You know, what we are doing here is we are translating at various points a message until it can be interpreted by the mind. Remember, it is the mind that wishes to see. Okay? Let's split this room in half and let's say this side of the room understands English. This side of the room understands Sinhalese. Okay? Now, for this side of the room to communicate with this side of the room, what would we need? A what later? A translator. We need a translator. So, for a translator, for us to pick a translator, you'd need someone who understands both languages. Make sense? So, let's say I'm the translator. For me to be the translator, I need to understand Sinhalese and I need to be able to speak English. Provided we have a translator who does the translation skillfully, if they are proficient in that task, now the two groups can communicate with each other, can't they? This is exactly what's going on. When you say, are you the English speakers or the Sinhala speakers? I forget now. English speakers. Oh, well done. So when you say, we love you. We love you. These people are looking blank. What did they just say? They're looking at me, hoping that I would translate what you have just said. So you say, we love you. And then now it's my turn to translate it for them. Api ogolonda kamathi ne. What's going to happen? Now you're going to get a few frowns. Right? They're not going to like you very much after that. But if I did a literal translation of it, api obata adare. Right? Now you'll there see smiles and they each other, you know, you look at each other and you'll both be smiling and you'll be, you know, it's jolly good. Everyone's very happy. See, translation happens at every point. What is the translation that happens at this point? Light energy translating to electrical energy. Let's hope that the translation's working properly. Let's hope so. The truth is, maybe there's no pen in my hand at all. Because what if the translations were completely gone awry? In other words, it's just completely bonkers. Let's say they say nothing, but I keep on translating. Would that not be possible? And if I've gone crazy, the translator's gone crazy. They're not saying anything. But I just keep on saying, you know, they say they love you. They say you're the best people in the whole wide world. And now, you know, they're bringing gifts and they're bringing cakes and all. So then you're like, what's going on? What's all this for? See, this is what's going on here. This is a translation happening here. This is one point where a translation happens. Light energy translated into electrical energy. What about this point here? This is the interface between the brain and the mind. Okay, so this process. Between the brain and the mind, there's an interface here. At this point, electrical energy is being translated to mind energy. Let's hope that translation is working properly. Why can't a drunk man walk in a straight line? Now you should have the answer. I can see some wives going. Yeah. Why can't a drunk man walk straight? It's because of this. Let me explain. The eye always sees a straight line. Okay, when they ask you to do the walk in a straight line test, the eye doesn't see a wavy line or a crooked line. The eye always sees a straight line because it's light waves that does that. Yeah, light waves always travel in straight lines. But when you come to the brain, the optic center, now the brain is, there's substance there, there's alcohol there. So the neurotransmitters, they've just gone crazy. They're doing all sorts of weird and wonderful things right now. And therefore, these messages, the translator is drunk. That's what's going on. Now the translator is drunk. It's not the eye, not the electrical signals, they're all working fine. It's not the optic center, but the environment in which the optic center resides. There's now alcohol in the blood, and therefore the neurotransmitters, they are impacted, and therefore in the brain, the translation that is happening, the rupa-rupa that arrives in the mind. Although you see a straight line, the rupa-rupa that is produced comes back, it's a wavy line. It's a crooked line. So therefore, now that is what the mind has to process. That's what's going on. Possibly, madam. Possibly. Possibly. Now, when we talk about hallucinations, I mean, you talk about purely mental hallucinations. Yeah. I mean, like, think about it. Like, when you strike your head, at the back of your head, you see lights. Yeah, I mean, when we were at school, this was one way that they taught us that is where the optic center was. Remember? If someone slapped you, the back of your head, try it. No, don't. If someone slapped you, the back of your head, if you fell down and you banged your head on the ground, right, you see flashes of light. So if light had to come from the eye, how is that possible? If seeing can only happen when something comes through the eye, how is that possible? If merely by whacking the back of your head, you can see flashes of light. How can you say that light has to enter through your eye? Because we are talking about a mental image. That image is created in the mind as long as the optic center of the brain and the interface with the mind is operational. As long as there's something going, some activity going on here, it's quite possible you can see hallucinations. Quite possible. So when you take drugs, for example, Right? If you've ever taken drugs. Those who take drugs, right, take drugs that give you hallucinations, hallucinogens. Yeah, when you take drugs that give hallucinations, you can have your eyes closed. So there's no light entering, but you see colors. What are they called? LSDs and so on? Yeah? So you see colors. Where do those colors come from? When you're dreaming, sometimes you see colors. Like some people, they dream black and white, but other people, they do actually dream colors. How is that possible? When you've shut your eyes, and if color has to come from the outside, how is it that in your dreams you see color? So the proof here is then that color is not something you see through your visual eyes. It's not visual eyes. It's not something you see with your eyes. Simple as that. Color is a creation in the mind. It is somewhere in this process that you see color. What the brain does is it takes an electrical signal that has just been delivered to it through the optic nerve, and then in that interface it has with the mind, it translates that electrical signal, let's call it a neural image, it translates that neural image. So this is a physical image, this is an optical image, this is a neural image, and this is a mental image. That is the translation that happens from point to point. So once it comes to the mental image, now that is what we call the rupa. But remember, at this point, you have not yet seen the rupa in the way that we talk about seeing things. It's just entered into the mind. It's just an input to the mind process. It is at that point that the mind process is triggered. So the rest of this also has to happen. Vedana is like a notification. It's like when you receive a text message, your phone goes off. Right? In the same way, when a rupa arrives in the mind, just imagine it's a door. When the rupa arrives in the mind door and you open it, this is the notification. That's like the knock. I'm here. So you open the door and you receive that rupa. And at that point you do sanya, which is to identify. At this point you begin to identify that it's a yellow color, a green color, a blue color, a red color, right? A black color, a white color, and so on. All of that happens at sanya, not at this stage. So this is receiving, this is registering, this is recognizing. You recognize what color it is, but you haven't seen it yet because it has to become perception. Then you have sankara, which is formation. Or rather response is the word that we've been using so far, which is ultimately the combined effect of rupa, vedana and sanya. The combined effect, it's a bit like when you want to see a particular color. Like say if you want to see the color white on a screen, you have the reds, the greens and the blues. These are the LEDs, right? They emit colors, and when red, green and blue are all lit at the same time, you see what color? You see white. So white is an effect because there are no white LEDs. Ever seen a white LED? No, but then how does an LED screen show you white? They do that by emitting red, green and blue all at the same time. When all three are emitted at the same time, the combined effect of that, the resultant effect of that is white. So how does an LED screen show you black then? Switch off red, green and blue. That's it. Now you see black. So the LED screen doesn't show you black, it just doesn't show you anything. But the LED screen shows you white by lighting up all three colors, and that's how it shows you various shades between white and black. So by lighting up green and red, it might show you one color. By lighting up blue and green, it might show you another color. So this is how the other colors are formed. I'll bring you a chart one of these days and show you how the different colors on a screen are displayed through a combination of these three primary colors on an LED screen. Then you'll get the idea better. But I think you get the gist of it, don't you? Yeah. So then, at this point, you merely have a mental image, and that image has now got to be processed. What sankhara does is it combines the effect of all these three stages. I'd like to give the analogy here, just to help you understand better this rupa vedana sanya sankhara vijnana process. Let's say we were dressing up a man. We want to dress someone up. Here you have a naked man. Here you have a man who's fully dressed, right? He's got a crown, he's got his jewelry, right? He's got his shoes, he's got his wristwatch, he's got some other jewelry, maybe a necklace and so on. How did he get from here to here? What's the first stage? This is where you start. What's the first stage? He's naked right now. What are you going to do first? Put the crown on? Put the jacket on? No, first you're going to put his? First you're going to put his? Underwear, of course. That's what you're going to do first. First you're going to have to put on his underwear. So here's the man, and he's got his underwear. Right? Next, what do you do? So here's a man with his underwear. What do you do next? You put a shirt on. Can you put the shirt on this guy? I mean, you could. That's not what I'm saying. We want to dress him up like a king. Okay? So you put the shirt and the trousers on the guy who's got the underwear on, right? So don't you see how this third effect has to be acted on the second effect? Meaning, the effect of whatever is done at each of these stages carries on. But the person who puts the underwear on, they stay. They don't carry on. So let's say there was a dresser, you know, this is the king's, what do you call them? Butlers? What do you call a king's dresser? Anyone? Is there a name for the guy who dresses a king? There must be one. I'm sure there must be one. Let's call it a servant, right? A servant, right? The king's servant. They're responsible for dressing these people. So here's the first servant here. He says, "Oh, welcome, sir. Very nice to have you. Please proceed. Right? Are you born? Please carry on." So this guy here, he puts on the king's underwear. What does he do after he puts the king's underwear on? He stays put. He doesn't carry on. He stays put. But what he does is he passes his effect to the next person in line. That effect is now the body with the underwear on. That's the effect. You get that? So now he's here. Now you put the trousers and you put the shirt. But the servant who put the shirt and the trousers on, they don't carry on, they stay there. But they pass on to the next servant in line. What he does is he puts on, say, the coat, right, and maybe some of the jewelry, but not the crown. And they pass on that effect to the next stage. Then when it gets to the final stage, all they have to do is put the crown on. And you have your king. Could this guy, this servant, have done all this on his own? Could he? No. He is dependent on the previous servants doing their bits. So this is the combined effect which ultimately comes to the last person, to the last servant. All the last servant has to do is put the crown on and just make sure that everything is prim and proper. That's exactly what goes on with the mind as well. So when you have the mind, you have your rupa, vedana, sanya, sankara and vijnana, you can kind of think as if, you can kind of think of this like the rupa which has just arrived in the mind through the translation that the mind did. This is the mental rupa. Now this effect is carried over to the next stage. Then vedana has its effect. What is the effect of vedana? Notification. To be made aware that a rupa has just arrived. I'm simplifying this quite a bit, right? We can get into more in-depth analysis of what Vedana entails and what are the various different ways of doing Vedana, and there are just, you know, six different types of Vedana and so on. But let's not get there so far. We just need to understand that is what Vedana does. And then once Vedana has done its part, it passes it on to Sanya. So Sanya couldn't happen if Vedana hadn't happened. Just like dressing the king up. And Vedana couldn't have happened if Rupa wouldn't have happened. So therefore, they are reliant on the previous step. Ultimately, it comes to Sankara, And then at Sankara, what they do is check everything is okay. Right? The combined effect of all these three, it brings it all together and then passes it on to Vijnana, which is like putting the crown on and now you have your king. At the point it comes to Vijnana, this is the point at which you perceive that there's an object out there. You cannot perceive anything previous to, prior to this stage. You can't feel it. So when you say that I see you, I see an object, what you're saying is this process has executed all the way until Vijnana. This is the aggregate, the five aggregates which form up, which comprise the mind. Yes, so if you don't recognize something, you recognize it as something you don't recognize. Isn't it? If you see, if I show you something you've never seen before, don't you recognize it? You do. What do you recognize it as? Something you don't recognize. That is also a recognition. It's an empty box. So that's where you give it names. Ah, this is a pen. This is black. This is white. This is a man. This is my wife. This is my husband, and so on. This is where you give it names and you recognize things. But there'll be strangers, people you don't know, things you've never seen before. But then you know it as something you've never seen before. So there is nothing in this world that you can't put a label on. Either you put it what it's called or you give it an unknown. So we know, we work with unknowns. That's what you call X and Y. We learned at maths, right? Variables, we call them unknowns. So once you get to Vijnana is when you actually perceive the said object. Now, all of this is to get to one point. The point is this. Let's go back to previous, last week's sermon. We talked about the colors, we talked about flowers, right? Here's that rose that you like. A red rose. Why do you like roses? Because they're red. You like roses because they're, go on. You like roses because they're red. Are they red? Are they red? Right. So you said you like roses because they're red. Once again. You like red roses, right? You don't like any old roses. You like red roses. There are others who like white roses. I mean, what other colors do they come in? Red, white, yellow roses and so on. So when you say, I love red roses, I have to ask you the question, which part of the rose is red? Red is not in the rose. Red is in the mind. I understand the point that's working in your head right now, which is, well, if it weren't for the pigments in the rose, you still wouldn't see the red, would you, Swami? No answer. I'm one step ahead, hold on. I know what you're thinking. Because I think like you, so I know what you're thinking. I know what you're thinking. You're thinking, well, Swami knows, I get the point that roses are not red, but the pigment is there, so therefore, isn't that why we should still be attached to the rose? No. Here's the deal. If you are attached to the rose because you think it's red, if I could give you red some other way, now you don't need the rose, do you? Let me repeat that. You like your red roses because they're red. Okay, that's why you don't like yellow roses. And that's why you don't like white roses. You like your red roses because they are red. Okay, let me give you red some other way. I promise you, I'll give you red. Are you happy now to let go of the rose? You've got to be. I mean, you have to be. Because if you like your roses because they are red, and I can give you red some other way, and it is the red that you want, then you should be able to let go of the rose. I don't think you understand my question. Let me try again. You like your red rose. Now, let's take these pens for instance, right? This is a red pen, this is a black pen. Right? If I ask you which of these two pens you like, some will say, I like the black pen, others will say, we like the red pen. Let's just assume that you all like the red pen. Okay? There is no difference between these two pens besides the fact that one is black and the other is red. Okay? They both write equally well. They last equally long, right? They're the same weight. In every other way, they are identical. Assume. The only difference here is that one is red and the other is black. So, we have to come to the conclusion then, mustn't we, that it is the redness about the pen that you like because everything else is here also. Yes? All agree? Okay. So, if it is the redness that you like and that is why you ask for the pen, how about I give you red separately? The red that you like. I give you red separately. At that point, must you not be okay and willing and happy to let go of the pen? Is what I'm asking you. You got to be. No. I understand where you're coming from. Let's travel on this train of thought for a second, right? I know you like the whole thing. We'll come to the ultimately. Although you think that you like the whole thing, when you break it down, you only like a very few things. Because you only know sight, sound, smells, taste and touch. What else do you know? I mean, what else do you know about this object, rather besides sight and sound and smell and taste and touch? I'm just taking one example. So sight is 1/5 of everything you know about this pen. Sight, sound, smell, taste, touch. Sight is 1/5 of everything you know about this pen. Sound is another 1/5. Yeah? Smell is another, taste is another, and touch is another. So rather than take the whole thing as a package, what I'm trying to ask you to do now is just let's focus on one. Let's take sight, we'll work through the other ones later. Let's just assume that the only thing that you are attached to about this pen, this is the reason you like this to this, the reason you prefer this pen to this pen, is because this is red. In every other way, this is identical. That being the case, if red is what you want and I could offer you red some other way, let's say I show you this pen, but there's a button that I can press somewhere and you see red, but I show you this pen. Now won't you be happy to walk away with this? You would. Why? Because you like a red pen. Yeah, I've given you the pen. I press the button that makes you see red. Now you see red pen. So you walk away with it. The reason that you want this particular pen is because you believe that redness is in the pen. But now, I'm helping you understand that redness is not in the pen. Red, the color red, this color is a fabrication of the mind. It's not in the pen. So, that being the case, if I could offer red to you, some other way. Say I had a magic wand. I wave it a couple of times and you see red. And then you have the pen. Now it doesn't matter which pen I give you, right? I can give you this pen, but you see red. Because I have the magic wand. I show you any pen and you see red pen. So now it doesn't matter which pen you have, right? See, this proves to you then that if you could get the sight that you wanted, okay? If you could be promised the sight that your heart desires, it wouldn't matter really what the object came like, what the object is like. Because after all, you don't see the object because it is the sight that you see and it is the sight that you're attached to. So if I can give you the sight that you're attached to some other way, now you are not fussed about the object. Does that make sense? Just put your hand up if that is not clear to anyone. Okay, good. I'm conscious of time as well, so I might actually bring us to a natural conclusion at this junction, so we can continue again in a couple of weeks. But even if you've understood that, that's a great victory. Because here's the point. If you can grasp this point, ladies and gentlemen, I think I can leave you with the comprehension that You are not really attached to objects, although you think you are. It is not the objects that you are attached to. It's the sight of the object that you are attached to. Because you are attached to what you see. If you couldn't see, would you care what color this was? Think about that for a second. If you were blind, would you care what color this was? Would you? No. So, why do you care now? Honestly, think about this. It makes me laugh just saying it out loud. I'll ask the question again, right? If you were blind, would you care what color this was? No, why do you care now? Because you can see. So, the difference is not in what color this actually is, right? It's what you can see that makes a difference. That's why you care what color this is. It is because when you look at it, you see blue. And if you don't like blue, now you have a problem with this. If you see blue, now you like this. If you were blind, you couldn't give a... what color this was. You wouldn't care at all. So you see, you don't care what the object comes like. What color it is, you don't care. As in, what this object is actually like, you don't care. What you care about is what it looks like. I'm talking about 1/5. Exactly, yeah. As long as it gets you what you want. So what is it you want? Sight, sound, smell, taste and touch. What else can you want from the outside world? Even if you did want something else, how can you get it? Because you only have the 5 senses. So, very good question. So the good lady asks, would a blind person not have attachment to the sight of an object? Right? The answer is this. A blind person would still have attachment to sight. That is why they were born with eyes but blind. See, if you had no attachment to sight, you wouldn't need a pair of eyes. Let me elaborate. So hold on with me, okay? Don't jump to any conclusions until I've said my part. Because I wish I could say all the things in my head in one sentence, but it doesn't work like that. I have to build up on each sentence, right? So, the reason that you're all born with eyes and ears, right? These senses is because you desire them. Your eyes are your mind slaves. Because the master wants, the master brings the slaves with them. Make sense? So, you being born blind does not mean that you don't want to see. It just means you can't see. Doesn't mean you don't want to see. If you didn't want to see, you'd be born without eyes. The mind creates the body to serve itself. That's why in the Brahma worlds, they only have sight and sound. In other words, the Brahmas are only attached to sight and sound. So they don't have a tongue with, like we do, to taste objects. They don't have a nose to smell objects because they have either subdued, suppressed, or if you go into the Brahmavas that are reserved just for the Anagami persons, there are 5 of them, in there they have given up attachment to smell and taste. So therefore you don't have those senses there. So the very fact that we're all human beings, us human beings, we are all attached to sights and sounds and smells and touch. All 5 of them. This is why we are born fully formed with all these 5 senses. However, because of our previous karmas, previous sins, you are prevented. Your sight is impeded. Your faculty of sight does not work, perhaps because you took away someone else's sight. That does not mean you don't want to see. It just means you want to see, but you still can't see. So that's no fun. Because it's like being put in prison. Let's go. If you think about a prisoner, right? they don't get to do what they want to do. Right? They can only do what they're allowed to do. Does that mean they don't want to do the other things? A prisoner, you know, wants to go to the beach. When you want to go to the beach, you get in your car, you drive to the beach. A prisoner wants to go to the beach. What do? They can't do much at all. So just because they don't go to the beach, does it mean that they don't want to go to the beach? No. They still want to do all the things that you and I want to do. That's why they call it prison. They call it prison because they want to do all the things that you and I want to do, but they're not allowed to do. That's why it's called prison. So someone who's born blind is someone who wants to see. That's why we call it blind. I mean, otherwise, you know, blindness doesn't make sense, right? What is blind? Blind is when you can't see, not when you don't want to see. Yes? What is deaf? When you can't hear, not when you don't want to hear. If you didn't want to hear, you wouldn't be born deaf. Because deafness is a description of a faculty that does not work. Deafness does not mean that you don't want it. In that case, this would also be deaf. In that case, this pen is also deaf. This pen is also blind. If that were the case. But no, the pen does not want to see. Therefore, you can't say that the pen is blind. Blindness is a description that talks about an impairment of a faculty. Make sense, madam? Yes. Absolutely. Absolutely. That's why if you took a blind man and you offered him the sense of sight, say a blind man who's blind from birth, they have a congenital defect. They're blind from birth. Okay? So they don't know what seeing is about. But if you ask them, you know, there's this other faculty that we all have that you don't have. Would you like it? What do you think they'd say? Oh, yes, please. And then let's say we gave him the sense of sight. Okay, we have a blind man, blind from birth. We gave him the sense of sight. We say, right, let's trial it. We'll give you sight for 2 minutes. At the end of 2 minutes, we switch it off. What do you think they'll say? Oh, thank you very much. I don't need it anymore. Do you think, what they're going to say? No, they'd say, please, can I have it back? Now you can consider them blind. Now they would know what being blind is about. Because a blind man from birth don't know what being blind is, but that doesn't mean they have no attachment to sight. That is why it is a sin or a vipaka of a bad karma. You have the vexation, but you can't relieve it yourself from it. What about? Yes. Yeah. So, if you're talking about mental attachment, sir, like where mental attachments are concerned, paralysis is a punishment. You know, say you want to go somewhere, but you can't get there. You want to look left, but you can't look left. But the vexation, the wanting to look left is still there. But you can't. That's a punishment, isn't it? It's like, again, being put back in prison. Isn't this why I always say, you know, I can't stop you from going blind. I can't stop you from going deaf. I can't stop paralysis taking over your life. But if you understand this, you won't suffer when it happens. What the Mahasangha can help you do is to free yourself of the wanting to see. So that the day you cannot see, it doesn't become a punishment. Because I can't stop life taking its toll on you. I can't stop your previous karmas taking its effect on you. Some of you might be able to see until your last moment, but others might go blind tomorrow. I can't stop that from happening. But if you can understand the Dhamma, then it wouldn't matter to you even if you go blind. It wouldn't matter to you even if you go deaf. Even it wouldn't matter to you if you were paralyzed. Because you don't want to get from place to place. You don't want to be able to see things. You don't want to hear things. If you don't want to hear things, it wouldn't matter whether you heard them or not. If you didn't want to see things, it wouldn't matter whether you could see them or not. It doesn't bother you one way or the other. But right now, you are bothered. That's why if something gets in your eye, you get really worried. You wash your face and you rub your eye because you're worried, you know, what might it do to my eyes? Because you love the sense of sight. But the point is, again, coming back to what we were discussing, if sight is not in the object, and I could give you sight some other way, then why? What is your attachment to the object? What is the meaning of your attachment to the object? What is the purpose of your attachment to an object, when an object does not serve you that purpose? I agree, it has pigments that help you see. This is my point again. It has pigments that help you see. I have a button that helps you see. Does it matter to you which one? As I put this pen in front of you, to be able to see color, this pen has pigments. Yes? I have a button. I press the button, you see red. These pigments help you see red. Does it matter to you which one? One way or the other, as long as you see red, you're okay, aren't you? Yeah? So if I can give you red, then what is your attachment to the object? You no longer are attached, will be attached to the object. But you will still be attached to red. That I get. But that is a topic for another day. What do you have to do about your attachment to red? Because even if I took the object away, I should still keep feeding you red, because you are still attached to red. Another day we'll discuss how you can get rid of your attachment to red. So once you get rid of your attachment to red, I have a red pen. You no longer need the pen, you no longer need the red, now you no longer need a red pen. Does that bother you? No. Then you're a free man. Yes, madam. You're not attached to yourself, this body, because you don't know what your body looks like. You can't say you don't know what your body looks like. You don't know what your body is like. Because a look is an image. An image is a mental fabrication. So things don't look like anything, if that makes sense. What does a pen look like? A pen. No, it has no answer. You're asking the wrong question. The pen doesn't look like anything because it doesn't have a look. A look is the product of an image. An image is created in the mind. So when you say the pen looks like this, what you're saying is an image has been formed in your mind courtesy of this object, but that image is now projected onto the object. So then you say this object looks like that. And so on. So when you stand in front of the mirror and you look at yourself in the mirror, it is not actually the physical body you're looking at. You're only looking at a mental image of it. That's why when you're not happy about it, you adjust it. Don't you? Yeah, don't you? That's where the makeup kit comes in. That's where the hairbrush comes in. That's where the barber comes in. That's where the hairdresser comes in. Right? That's why you keep adjusting this physical patavyapo tejo vayu. That's out there. This is what we call the object. So I'm not suggesting that an object doesn't exist. All I'm saying is an object does not have a sight. That's the point I want to get across to you. There are objects in this world. Okay? There are objects. But objects don't have sights. Objects don't have sounds. Objects don't have smells. Objects don't have tastes. And objects don't even have touch. Whoa, yes. let's continue the next day. I have to conclude the sermon here. Okay, last question. That's all right. I'm glad you contemplated on that in that way. She said, I don't have the hetu. Look at that. It's wonderful, isn't it? What profound contemplation. That's okay. I made a resolve. May you forget the question so I can conclude the sermon. No, I didn't do such thing. I can't. Like I said, I'm a very normal human being. I don't have any of these powers. I don't have any supernatural powers. I can't control your mind, right? I can't see what you're thinking. I can't give a sermon that addresses your problem precisely. I can't do any of that stuff. Your merits are responsible for your comprehension. What is being said is all determined by that. Of course, I practice the Dhamma, so I have compassion within me. Right? This is where the hetu is, and you have the pratyaya. So you have the conditions and I have the causes. So what happens is these causes and conditions, they come together to create an effect. That's how the world works. That's how everything works. Right? How does the wind blow? When there's an area of low pressure, there's air, around it. The low pressure area is the cause. The air around it are the conditions. No, other way around. Wait. Yes, to get the point across to you, this is how I want to dress it up. The low pressure area is the cause. The air around you are the conditions. So the conditions, they move into an area of low pressure, creating wind. In the same manner, you have merits. That is your currency. I have compassion. I'm not trying to sell myself here. What I'm saying is, that is what's going on here. At the Mahasangha, we have compassion. We have loving kindness because we practice the path. Right? So, when your merits combine with compassion of the preacher, now you have the Dhamma, your understanding. That is an effect of that. This is how causes and conditions come together to create an effect. This is the cause and effect principle. Everywhere you look, that is what goes on. So there is no me doing miracles here. There is no you doing miracles there either. There is neither you nor me. What is there are conditions and causes coming together to create effects. Hetu palavada. Right, let's conclude for today. So once again, as a reminder, no sermon next week, which is the 14th of April. We have the oil anointing ceremony in commemoration of the new year on the 15th, which is a Monday. The auspicious time is 17 minutes past 10, so please don't everyone come at 16 minutes past. Come in a little bit early. And also, don't come in much later, because that way, you know, if you all come in, because everyone else is going to be there by 7:15, so, you know, 10:15, so we'll go in at 11 o'clock, then everyone comes in at 11 o'clock. So, you know, just come in whenever you come in, right? Don't try to beat the system. Just come in whenever you come in. I don't know whether you're going to come in together or individually. That's up to you to decide. But the auspicious time is at 17 minutes past 10. That's when we will start it. But once we've started it, then we will do it. We'll conduct the ritual until we have all been anointed with the oil. At the end of that, there will be an alms procession. So we will be offering alms to you on that day. Were you there last year for this? No, some of you were. I can see a few nods, but the majority of you weren't. So if you want the Swami Nuhansis to be offering you some kiribat and some kaun kokis and so on, then please bring yourselves to the monastery on that day. And in the afternoon, we'll have Guru Hamdro, who will be giving a sermon after the alms proceedings are concluded. And then our next sermon will be not next Sunday, but the Sunday after. Right, let's do the merit transfer and bring today's sermon to a close. Okay, so first and foremost then, let us remind ourselves how incredibly fortunate we are to be in receipt of the Lord Buddha's teaching. Let us transfer the merits that we have all acquired by listening to the Dhamma, preaching the Dhamma, inviting the Swami Nuhansi to deliver the sermon, and creating a conducive environment so that all could come together under this one roof and practice the path and attain their salvation. Let us transfer all these merits that we have all acquired to the bhikkhus and bhikkhunis, upasakas and upasikas, who have since time immemorial protected and preserved the sublime teachings of the Buddha and passed it down through the generations of the noble lineage in the form of the Tripitaka, which is thankfully available to us today to study and understand and comprehend the Dhamma. Let us also transfer these merits to the members of the Mahasangha present throughout the world, including the chief prelates of all of the chapters who have dedicated their lives to the noble path and have committed themselves towards the betterment of all sentient beings. Let us also transfer these merits to the monks and nuns resident in your local temples and nunneries who have always been by your side through thick and thin, come rain or shine. Let us also transfer these merits to Guru Swami Nuhansi, as well as all the monks resident at the monastery and the Anagarika and Anagarika communities attached to the monastery. Excuse me. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to those who make great efforts to disseminate the teachings of the Buddha, be that by transliterating these talks, sharing them out with others, or inviting others to join them. It is also transfer these merits to our devotees and friends of the monastery who, for the sake of merits to help them attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana, continue to sustain the Mahasangha. This includes everyone from those of you who provide the Mahasangha with shelter, arms, robes and medicines, as well as pass on their know-how and continue to extend their well wishes. May they all rejoice in these merits, and by the power of these merits, may they be healed of any physical and mental ailments and overcome any obstacles to their spiritual progress. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to our mothers and fathers, brothers and sisters, sons and daughters, grandparents, uncles, aunts, cousins, nephews and nieces, our friends, our acquaintances, our employers and our employees, our teachers, everyone and anyone who've gone the extra mile on our behalf and who've left no stone unturned in our service, for all the help, support and assistance that they would have offered us throughout their lives. Let us take a moment to transfer these merits to all of them out of gratitude and gratefulness. Let us transfer these merits to all. May they all be healed of any physical and mental ailments and overcome any obstacles to their spiritual progress. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to the Devas and Brahmas, spirits and demons, primarily the Sakadeva, as well as all the numerous gods and deities who have committed themselves to fulfill and preserve the Sambuddha Sasana. Let us transfer this merits to our guardian deities who keep a watchful eye over us and keep us out of harm's way. May they prosper in divine power and wisdom. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer this merits to our loved ones and those who have passed away in our name, to our forefathers, our ancestors, reminding ourselves that it is in their blood, sweat and tears today we are able to enjoy the pleasures and the comforts of life as we do, as well as practice the path in peace and harmony. Let us transfer these merits to all of them. Let us also transfer these merits to members of the armed forces as well as the police force who sacrificed their lives to protect the peace and harmony of our nation, as well as those who lost their lives in the wars, be they friend or foe. Let us also transfer these merits to those who have lost their lives in natural disasters and calamities such as the tsunamis and earthquakes, landslides, fires, floods, disasters of all sorts and the pandemics included, reminding ourselves that in this infinitely long journey of samsara, they will all have been mothers and fathers to us, brothers and sisters to us, friends and acquaintances to us, those who would have helped us, supported us and assisted us in any way, shape or form possible and available to them. Therefore, out of immense gratitude and gratefulness towards all of them, let us transfer all the merits we have acquired throughout the day, from listening to the Dhamma by making offerings to others and helping others to practice the path, listen to the sermons in peace and comfort. To all of them, may by the power of these merits, if any of them have been born in the woeful planes, they redeem themselves and be born in the blissful plane. May by the power of these merits, they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. And finally, may by the power and blessings of all the merits we have acquired throughout the day, we be able to witness the advent of many hundreds of thousands of arahant nuhanses on this blessed land. And finally, may you and I, and everyone who's helped make this program a success, become a arahat nuhanse or an arahat teranin nuhanse in this very life itself and in the era of the Gautama Supreme Buddha itself. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. May the blessings of the Noble Triple Gem be with you all. The members of the Mahasangha will transfer their blessings to you.
Raga ginnen midetnva, dvesha ginnen midetnva, moha ginnen midetnva, nibbana parama sukhayan, sukhita taravetnva, nibbana parama sukhayan, sukhita taravetnva, mamada siyalu loka siyalu satnvayo, nibbana parama sukhayan, sukhita taravetnva, nibbana parama sukhayan sukhita taravetnva nibbana parama sukhayan sukhita taravetnva raga gini niveva dvesha gini niveva moha gini niveva nivansata labeva nivansata labeva nivansata labeva.
තුනුරුවන්ගේ සුවිසි අනන්ත මහා ගුණ බැලෙන් සීල ලෝක සීල සත්‍යයෝම නිබ්බාන පරම සුඛයෙන් සුගතතර වෙත්වා. සාදු සාදු සාදු.